erupting, his rage and pain congealing into something base and primordial. Rising gingerly, Karata tested the crutch and his leg. It hurt like hell, but he was up at least. Another groan from Farkum, and now his bleary gaze found the hired gun. He swore, a veritable barrage of expletives, first promising riches, and then retribution, if Karata did not act to rescue him.
Get me out! Get me out!
Farkum blathered, pushing pathetically at the spur, firmly pinning him to the deck. He flailed and lurched, his obese frame contorting ineffectually.
Karata!
He snarled, and then, as he realised his plight, he uttered, much more softly and incredulously,
Karata?
The hired gun turned away, his only gift to his master, a contemptuous look, as he shuffled through the side hatch of the grounded gun cutter and into the ruined building beyond.
Karata! Karata, you bastard! I'll skin you, horse son, guttersnipe! Karata! Help me! Any price! Name any price! Karata!
Farkum's screamed threats and accusations followed him, as did pleading and weeping. As he limped away from the gently burning wreck, Karata saw the pallid converging. They were still a little way off, enough time for him to be on his way. A maglev tunnel offered a way out, and he made for it with a little urgency. As fat as Farkum was, the pallid were voracious and would not feast for long. He had put a decent distance between himself and the wreck as the pallid reached it. Farkum's screams rose to fever pitch, a shrieking, girlish terror that abruptly cut off into silence. After a last look back, darkness swallowed Karata as he entered the maglev tunnel. It went deeper into low sink, running south, but that hardly mattered. The gate was impenetrable. No one would be getting through. Although a last image surfaced in his mind as he ventured into the black, of the pallid at the gate, climbing. A low hum betrayed the lethal energy coursing through the rail, and Karata made certain to stay clear, hugging the opposite side of the tunnel. Slowly, his eyes adjusted to the darkness. A gaunt, pale visage loomed for him. A pallid, slow and ailing. He shot it through the head, flechette pistol in one hand, crutch in the other. He kept moving. Debris caught underfoot, and he stumbled more than once. A second pallid staggered from the murky darkness. It wasn't alone. Karata killed it, and the rest. The flechette pistol clicked empty. He patted his body glove, but had no further reloads, so he tossed the priceless weapon and focused on moving. Limping hard, sweat beading his face, sticky beneath the body glove, Karata felt the fear return. He heard them nearby, shuffling, sniffing, snarling. He felt the tunnel rumble as a crackle of energy surged through the rail. The maglevs ran on an automated schedule, and the next carriage flashed by, raucous and bright. The harsh light revealed more pallid, lots more. They clambered down the tunnel, emerging from alcoves and nooks, starved and desperate. Karata hurried on, but the broken leg slowed him like an anchor. A glow flickered ahead, the promise of a station. He pushed on, harder, striving to reach the light, to reach salvation. Heart thudding, breath scything. Then he fell, the crutch having snapped beneath him. White pain flared, every nerve ending aflame. A scent of rot and dank wafted over, and he knew they were close, too close. He felt the electrical jolt of the rail. It was near enough to touch. Karata knew men like him died in one of two ways. Either they were killed in the prosecution of their profession, or their fallen morality would eventually catch up to them and they would swallow a bullet to escape their self-hatred. He did not believe in the latter, thinking it the way of cowards. A sociopath like him had no morality. He only had his mantra, survive or die. Rancid breath washed across his ear, pricking his nostrils. Karata made his choice. He reached out and seized the rail. Chapter 23. Buried in the Flesh. The mule headed north, its passengers riding in funerary silence, the rig's jangling metal refrain a lament to their mourning. The precinct house was a lightless and towering shadow in the background, its haunted shell gratefully left behind. A few miles off yet lay the border, and from there a few more miles to the gate to Uphive. Morgravia watched as Meagher submitted to slumber again, as if the horrors had retreated to lick their wounds, or perhaps they simply lay in wait. Hunched figures still shuffled along the periphery, too far away and too slow to be of concern. Meagher had never been an affluent place, but now it belonged to the pallid. Drover had the wheel. He had been quiet since they left the precinct, uncharacteristically so. Barrack slept fitfully in the back, his injuries having earned him a respite, his head on Jaina's shoulder. The broker sat alongside, a dignified distance between them, staring into the shadows outside the window as the skeleton of the settlement slipped by in jagged silhouette. She clung to the wrist of her ruined hand, as if the very act of grasping it would ease the pain of her fused fingers. "This horror," the broker said, her voice barely louder than a murmur in the back. Jaina stirred, but Barrack slept on. "It will consume this place. I can taste it on the air, the fear. It will drive us all mad. Perhaps it already is." Jaina leaned over to put a consoling hand on the broker's shoulder. "Have hope. We are alive. If we can reach the border, then it will not matter," said the broker, and turned towards the front of the cab. "She knows." Morgravia looked up, but didn't speak. Her skin prickled, as if reacting to an intense heat, but it was cold in the cab. Sweat beaded her face, and she wiped it away with a gloved hand. "She knows what follows," the broker continued. "If this does not stop, they will burn it, her kind, to preserve the body, sever the limb. Is that not the way? A purging fire? No one is getting through that gate alive. They simply will not allow it." The bitterness radiated as palpably as the heat prickling Morgravia's feverish skin. A sense of violation had begun to overwhelm her, like mites burrowing into her flesh. Only through an effort of will did she keep it in check. Her chest thumped with palpitations as a bout of dyspnea took hold. Her throat constricted, her every nerve raw and burning. Pain flared in her eye like a hot needle rammed into the iris. Her will collapsed, like a dam capitulating against the wrath of a raging torrent. It gave, and so did she. "Let me out," she croaked, so hoarse it barely registered. Drover turned an ear, but hadn't really heard her. Morgravia gasped, wrenching out a breath, barely able to draw in more. She clenched the rig's front panel, finally getting Drover's attention. "You all right?" he asked, looking askance at her, his eyes mainly on the road. An old mining district loomed in the distance, abandoned and drenched in foreboding. The rig had taken the main road that led through it, the ramshackle silos and warehouses drifting closer. "Let me out," Morgravia said, louder, a fire surging through her flesh as whatever had been buried within fought for release. Drover frowned. "In this wasteland? There's nothing here." "Right now, damn it," Morgravia shouted, the urge to be violently sick forcing her stomach to contract. The rig slewed to a halt on a patch of scrubland. She tumbled out, half leaping, half falling, and vomited all over the ground. spitting out the last of it, Mulgravia expected to see something in her ejection, some grim evidence of the contagion she harboured. A fetid pool of regurgitant swilled before her, but it was largely an accretion of bile. It stung her throat, hot and acerbic. The sensation did not end with the evacuation of her stomach. It stirred the feeling within, like surgical tools probing.
"I need a moment," she said,
gasping at the pain inside her and staggering towards the dilapidated shell of a manufactory, limned by the glow of the rig's lamps. She needed to get away, out of sight, a few minutes to think, to understand. Only the lower floor of the building remained, but Mulgravia had caught sight of an ablutions block, old, disused, but still standing. She made for it.
"Inquisitor?"
asked the broker, before opening the door and stepping outside.
"What the hell is happening?"
said Drover.
"Stay with the rig,"
Mulgravia called to him, and said nothing more. The broker started to follow her. Drover leaned out of the window.
"And where are you going? This ain't no time to be wandering off." "I forget the part where the money I paid you affords you the right to question me,"
the broker replied, and walked away. Drover swore again, lighting up another cheroot as he watched her go. A narrow gantry bridged a labour trench that led to the entrance of the manufactory. Whatever ores dug from the earth it had once refined had dried up long ago. It was lightless and cold, like a snuffed candle in winter. An industrial odour pervaded. The manufactory had been stripped of anything of worth. Dust had settled like a shroud. Gang insignia daubed slate-grey walls. Evidence of recent fires littered the ground. Chains hanging from the high ceiling reminded her of nooses as they gently swayed this way and that, clinking whenever they touched. The ablutions block was appended to the main manufactory and comprised several small cells. Each had a basin, mirror and wash faucet. Grimy off-white ceramic tiled the immediate surrounds. As she stepped into one of the cubicles, Mulgravia felt her heart thundering like heavy ordnance. The pain flared, a sensation of violent rebirth running through her body. She clung to her sides, hoping to hold in whatever felt like it was trying to push itself out. Her eyes burned, and she clenched the lid shut as she engaged the old sodium lamp above the basin and clung on like she had in the barracks. She breathed, slow and steady, reciting the mantra. "A mind without purpose will walk in dark places." She reminded herself who she was, what she was, despite the ever-present sense of disassociation. Her will was everything. She had seen the abyss and had not flinched. And slowly, but certainly, Mulgravia found calm. Her breathing eased, and her heart resumed a more natural rhythm.
"Is this why?"
a voice asked behind her. It was the broker, having followed her from the rig.
"An injury. Taken at the precinct house. That's all," said Mulgravia,
though she didn't turn around at first, nor did she look at her reflection.
"Not a good lie," the broker said. "I have heard better."
Mulgravia clenched her fists, the echo of the itch in her flesh stirring.
"What do you want?"
"I want to know your secret. Why are you out here?"
"I learn secrets. I don't divulge them."
"I have to say, it intrigued me,"
the broker continued, as if Mulgravia hadn't spoken.
"An inquisitor in need of an unsanctioned psyker? I thought it might be a trap at first. That's why I brought a friend."
Mulgravia licked her lips, surprised at how dry they'd become. She tasted bile and winced at the caustic flavour.
"You don't mean Aram Drover, though?"
The broker's expression soured. Mulgravia saw it in the mirror, relieved to see her own face reflected back at her and not something else.
"He is a hireling," Exactly as you said, the broker went on. Hallow's End had a reputation. I thought I might need the extra protection.
And the cipher you gave him?
Useless. I just needed you to believe I had a proxy who could deliver what you wanted.
So you were planning on betraying me?
Of course.
And him too?
He had already been paid. He loses nothing.
So why are you really here? It's not to know my secret. It's to divulge yours, isn't it? She turned then, her face impassive. You're the empath. A moment of silence stretched between them, a gulf of indecision which would change their relationship forever. In the end, the broker decided to relent.
How long have you known?
I wasn't certain until I saw the brand. That's a witch mark, an old one. I assume you escaped your persecutors. What was it? Local militia? Bounty hunter?
Neither. They were just men, blinded by fear and hatred. Petty minds who wanted to hurt what they didn't understand because it made them feel safer. I killed them.
After they branded me, I eviscerated their minds, turned them into empty vessels.
Then I fled and found solace of a kind in Meager. I plied my trade, became known as the broker. Did well. I am good at knowing what someone wants.
And now you're being hunted again. The broker gave a bitter smile.
I was incautious, an ear to the ground. I heard a hook had been cast. I was not lying when I said I had made enemies.
What if it's me? Said Morgravia flatly. What if the reason I am here is you? She smiled again, wryly.
You are not here for me, and we both know it. More likely, it is a...
A shot rang out, startling in the quiet of the ablutions block. Morgravia drew her pistol on instinct, then saw the red bloom unfolding across the broker's robes, or the empath's. It made no difference when she fell, slowly to one knee, and then lay on her side, gasping for breath. It's like I told you. Aram Drover's voice issued from the shadows. Not everyone is always what they seem. He emerged slowly, a spectre from the gloom. The charm remained, but tempered by something cruel and greedy. You'll drop that hand cannon, if you please, he said, wagging his gun at her. I like you, Inquisitor, but not that much. And unlike that witch dying on the ground over there, I ain't the trusting kind. Morgravia did as he asked, her heavy stub pistol landing with a thud. You were hunting her, she said, putting herself between Drover and his mark. Not me, specifically, but I took a contract. I like to get close to my kills before I pull the trigger. And she was under your nose all this time. Just like he was right under mine, and I missed it. I'll admit, that's a little galling. But I didn't know the empath, what she looked like, her hideouts. No one did. That's what interested me. I did know of her broker, though. She puts herself around, has to in her profession, I suppose. I kept my ear out, found out someone was looking. He nodded to Morgravia, and offered my services as a mercenary. Who's even left to pay you? I'll find a precinct house that'll honour the fee. If not, I'll find her stash. Shouldn't be too hard. I reckon there'll be enough there to compensate. Broker was a rich woman, still is. Not for much longer. I can't let you kill her. Drover's face rumpled in mock perplexity.
Don't see as how you have much choice, given I'm the one holding the gun. And I don't see your skull-faced assassin anywhere hereabouts. She's a hell of a thing, by the way. Never seen anyone kill like that. Where'd you find her? Oh, that's right, he said,
wagging a finger in self-remonstration. You don't remember, do you? Can't imagine what that must be like. You have my sympathies, and I mean that sincerely. But I have a contract to fulfil, and I'd like to do so before there's no leaving this place. So, if you don't mind. Can't do it. Drover gave a curt sigh and bit his lip, agitated. How's about this? I let you get what you need from her, and then you head on your way. I get my fee, you get your memories. No downside. Can't do it. He swore. She's about half dead already. Nothing to gain here by being obstinate. Now, stand aside so I can finish her off. No reason for you to die. Mulgravia held her ground. She felt the itch, strong and insistent, the slow uncoiling of something within her, a waking presence reacting to the threat.
I am a servant of the Holy Ordos, she said with difficulty, trying to hold the itch at bay. But it grew, expanding, conjoining as the red dream became suddenly more tangible. Cutting, parting bones, reshaped, replaced with metal and piston blades and gears red as blood cables and wires like veins.
And I have no desire to kill one, said Drover. But I will.
You'll bring the wrath of the Inquisition down on you, she gasped, the ends of her fingers burning as she felt something sharp pushing through the tips.
I doubt that. If they gave a shit about you, they'd already be here, said Drover, seemingly oblivious to Mulgravia's discomfort. She reeled.
Is this a symptom of my fractured mind?
He was still talking. This city is going to hell. It'll be assumed you died along with it. She blinked, and a grainy red haze overlaid her vision. A data stream scrolled across her iris, the focusing rings expanding and contracting, gauging, measuring.
I can bring you hell, she said, trying to hold on, trying not to collapse as she teetered on the brink.
Is that what you call her?
Only to her face, said Mulgravia,
glancing at the shadows behind him. Drover half turned, fearing the effigy of death in his midst, and pulled his aim. Just enough. Mulgravia rushed him, her monomolecular blade carving a silver blur through the air. She heard the pistol retort and felt the pinch in her side. Her armour absorbed the worst of it, but the bullet found flesh. A second shot followed the first, this one pushed aside before the muzzle flared. Mulgravia's hand on the barrel. A tile splintered with the impact. Her other hand slashed up with the knife, carving a ragged red line through the Drover's duster. He swore.
Can't believe I fell for that,
he growled, still wrestling to draw a bead on the Inquisitor.
I must really like you.
Firing off a burst, he raked the wall instead. More splinters, shattering ceramic. Mulgravia brought her knee up into his stomach. Drover let out a grunt, tossed one pistol and drew the other. Bleeding profusely, he got off a shot, and Mulgravia cried out as the bullet clipped her shoulder. She was empty-handed, and as the auto-pistol fell from Drover's nerveless fingers, he realised why. A monomolecular blade was embedded in his chest, up to the hilt. No, it wasn't the knife that lay on the ground, flecked with blood. She had dropped it. A blade extruded from Mulgravia's flesh, her fingers having split and conjoined into a lengthened spear of metal. Drover staggered back as the blade slid out of him, the tongue of metal retracting as if sentient, and spat up a little blood. Barging into a basin, he slid to his rump, legs akimbo, arms by his side. Breath soared from his mouth. Blood pooled in his lap. He gaped, eyes widening as a look of sheer, unreasoning terror contorted his features. He reached for a gun that wasn't there. Then he slumped over and did not move again. Mulgravia groaned, clutching at her arm, aghast at the bloody spar of metal inexplicably conjoined with her body. A lurching sensation overcame her, like a moment of disconcerting weightlessness before a fall. Head spinning, she crumpled onto her elbows and knees as something uncurled inside her gut. Letting out a thin, wordless cry, she tried to crawl as kaleidoscope images surfaced in her mind, crashing together like disjointed tides. The red dream, every aberration, every abuse and incursion of her flesh, collapsing and reforming, coalescing. The scent of chemical sanitization and iron, of meat and cold, tangs the air. A laboratory takes form. Robed figures huddle around the slab upon which she is lying. They are festooned with blades, with scalpels and saws and drills and hot red beams. Their regard is alien and automated. She is a living autopsy, splayed out for experimentation. Her skin is pinned back, her organs exposed. A heart pulses, rapid and arrhythmic. It glistens in the cool light like a fleshy apple mutated with arteries. It takes a few moments for her to realise it is hers. A pair of lungs inflate and deflate in stuttering dyspnea. Also hers. Ribs, cracked open and wide, admit invaders. They come with the intent to cleave, to cut, to sever and partition. They click and whir. Her faceless surgeons, creatures of metal and the sparest flesh. They remove bone and parts of her intestines. Steam rises from several nearby basins, reeking with an abattoir stench. Her surgeons emit a series of curt shrieks and whines, undercut by hissing static as they converse. Passing their language is impossible, and leaves only the impression of screaming, a cacophony of hoarse, emotionless screaming. And she realises she is screaming too, in horror, as agony descends in a red veil and the reality of their violation of her embeds itself like cold ice. As she is remade, and the surgeons cut and converse, deaf to her dismay, as cold and uncaring as the void, and in the shadows, two red suns loom over her, before blackness sweeps in and the rest is lost. She tasted dirt and realised her face was touching the ground. Mulgravia rose slowly and experimentally, fearing what she would see. She looked at her arm, but it was flesh again, albeit with a thin seam of dried blood around the forearm and the gaps between her fingers. Like a zip or the petals of a flower closing at dusk, the irrefutable reality of that struck her like a blow, and she fought to quash the profound sense of unravelling. Mulgravia clutched her shoulder, biting back the pain from the bullet hole. It gave her focus, an anchor to ground her. It staved off the nebulous sense of dread rising like bile up her throat. Trauma had provoked a reaction. The tenebrosity veiling her memories had parted a fraction, allowing in a sliver of revelation. But still the answers would not come. She saw the empath lying in a pool of blood and crawled to her. One glance at the wound in the empath's chest, and Mulgravia knew she was near death. The psyker reached out to the Inquisitor, fingers trembling. Her mouth gaped, opening and closing in a futile attempt at speech. Mulgravia took her hand, but the empath wrenched it away and strained to touch the Inquisitor's forehead. Trembling herself now, Mulgravia leaned in and closed her eyes. She felt the chill caress of hoarfrost and the convulsion of an electrical charge as the gated vaults of her memory opened and were let out. Chapter 24. Burning for Our Sins. After what felt like several hours, the terminus of the maglev rail led Christo and the others to a dilapidated church. an old, tarnished effigy of the eagle crested a broken spire and bore down on anyone walking beneath it like a fell omen. Fire had devoured the roof, leaving black spurs like ribs in its wake. The reek of cooking meat choked the air, directing Christo's gaze from the monolithic church to a nest of hanging cages. Within each cage, he saw partly burned bodies, their limbs like sticks of charcoal kindling. A glance at convocation, at the dewy state of his wide eyes, betrayed the fact that he had put these men and women to death. He had judged them, possibly first with the blade, but then with the flame. He had done so under the auspice of the Emperor's will, framing it as righteous, necessary, even. Men such as the priest always sought excuses for their depravity. Christo knew then that he would have to kill this man, or he would surely kill all of them. The alternative was indoctrination, subsumption into the cult.
His glory upon us, Convocation whispered, nodding for his flock to drag the prisoners onward.
It had been fortified, this church of perverted faith. Thorny tank traps stood outside, an impediment to the restless dead. Scaffolds holding up makeshift watch stations were occupied by snipers carrying crude rifles. A gate fashioned from two pieces of tank armour plate, doubtless stolen from an abandoned manufactory and welded to a pillar and hinge, barred the way. At Convocation's shouted proclamation, the gate opened, admitting them into the heart of his twisted fiefdom. Beyond its fortifications, the church was less rigorously intact. Its narthex had all but collapsed into disrepair, amounting to little more than a fractured arch of stone. Only when they entered the crumbling nave did Christo finally understand what had happened to the people of Mega, at least those yet living. Crude pens had been erected, and here the survivors were amassed, dirty, hollow-eyed, and awaiting judgment. And before them lay their fate. A massive pit had been dug into the heart of the nave, extending down into darkness so deep it could have been fathomless, the stone flags split and sundered around it. The sheer size of it defied belief as a man-made excavation, and yet the sounds of toil from below could be heard faintly echoing, putting the lie to its bottomless appearance. A crude wooden gantry zigzagged down one interior flank, disappearing into darkness. Another jutted out over the pit like a gangplank. The pens looked down into this great yawning chasm, a sacrificial pit in all but name, the burn cages suspended above it. Their inhabitants were both fuel for sacrifices and recruits for Convocation's army. Queues of pale-faced, haunted individuals snaked from the pens to a pair of lecterns, where a robed acolyte interrogated them. Christo couldn't hear what was being said, but he saw the outcome of these terrifying interviews. A false answer, a sentiment that did not support the faith of the divine, and you were dragged to the cages and hoisted over the pit to await immolation. Demonstrate enough fervour, a taste for the aberrant creed of madmen, and you were awarded a mask and a cudgel or knife. There was weeping, screaming. Several prisoners wore the torn uniform of proctors. Most of these ended up with a mask. Christo saw one poor soul beaten to death for trying to resist, and another slit her own throat with a jagged piece of glaceic rather than face the flames. The cages were filling, and he had the sense that the lesser acolytes had been waiting for their high priest to return. 18 cages in all, suspended at various heights. The charred corpses of their former occupants were released by long pikes unlatching the bases of the cages and then letting the blackened remains fall as ashen offerings. It wasn't always clean, though. skeletal hands came apart from their former wrists and were left clinging to the bars like fetishes, a grim foretaste of what awaited whoever next entered the cage. Christo could scarcely believe his eyes.
Holy throne!
He watched as a factorum worker was led onto the gangplank, the two lecterns either side looming down upon him. Rather than submit to the ruling of the court, the man ran, bolting for the gangplank's edge, preferring a quick death to being burned alive. A pistol shot rang out, clear as a clarion, and the man slumped a few feet from making his fatal leap. Crimson blossomed on his back as two masked thugs fetched him and dragged him away.
"None shall besmirch his glory,"
uttered Convocation, the pistol in his hand still trailing smoke from its recently used barrel. He had appeared silently alongside Christo, his tread soft, but his aroma unmistakable.
"You asked me before where you were being taken," he said. "Look now and see. Ruination, the end of mankind as we know it, and the Emperor's judgment over all sin."
"You think that pit is the Emperor?"
"It is the maw that must forever be fed. For the Imperium to thrive, sacrifices must be made."
"This is insane,"
it slipped out, as natural as breathing. But the priest did not react adversely, though his eyes widened as he sermonized.
"It is the only sanity that remains to us. A return to the old ways, to fire and purity. His will."
He gestured, and they were ushered into the pens. As they stumbled through the gate, joining with a mass of others who were awaiting their fate, Christo took Corinna in his arms. She hugged him back fiercely, her eyes afraid.
"What is happening? What are they doing?"
Christo shook his head. He had no answer.
"Stay together," he said. "I'll get us out."
"How?"
"I don't know,"
he replied, his gaze wandering the crowd for inspiration. The earlier hysteria that had led to the deaths had faded, replaced by a weary acceptance. The prisoners remained huddled, but shuffled towards their end like dull-eyed cattle. Celestia stared about herself, bewildered.
"It's an aberration," she said. "They are depraved. The mad have begun to eat each other."
Christo reached out and took her hand. The zealots had taken her ceremonial sword. Celestia, wise enough not to try to stop them, but she watched as Vanquish was presented to the priest and Convocation slid it into his belt, a trophy of conquest. She had already earned several dark looks from the priest's flock, her religious vestments a challenge to their own twisted beliefs. They had yet to act upon it, but Christo thought it was only a matter of time.
"I shall see it return to you,"
he said, another promise he likely couldn't keep.
"They will perish for this,"
she answered, her voice vehement.
"Not for the sword, but for what they have done in his name."
Truly, the Emperor had forsaken this place, and in his stead had arisen something darker, a simulacrum of the imperial faith, but one held up to a dirty mirror and reflected back. Staring into the darkness of the pit, Christo could not help but wonder what was down there and why these twisted men and women had raised the church of their religion around it. A shout rose from the ranks of the divine, as if in answer. Part signal, part affirmation.
"Look away,"
he told his daughter. But she did not. None of them did. The cages were lit. The screaming began anew. Chapter 25. Fractured Memories. Fragments resolved. Pieces of a greater whole. She didn't remember everything, not immediately. Oshanti flying the ship as they came into land over the haunted spires of Blackgeist. His laughter, as Roper made a dumb joke, stroking his coiffured moustaches for effect. Roper's cold, dead eyes, as she crawled over his gunshot body. Hell, eager to leave the ship's hold, and her graceful cartwheeling as the rear hatch opened. Carnegie, following in her wake, making some sardonic comment about the ebullience of youth. And then, Carnegie atomized by a flash of light, too late raising her force field, too drunk to notice the trap their enemies had set. The memories returned in a violent cascade that threatened the banks of Morgravia's mind. They were ill-ordered, confused, a melange of thoughts and emotions. A word rose prominently, however, and the Inquisitor knew instinctively that this was the reason she had been hunting. Valgast. A cult of the machine, of arcane technologies and prescribed science. They were a cancer requiring excision, and Morgravia had been the scalpel. That had been then, before she was sprawled on the ground, jackknifed in agony, before her mind had been flensed and raked, before her agents were slaughtered with only the sparest flickers of memory as proof of their existence. Morgravia had lived. She had been taken, bloody and beaten, and dragged before the heads of the cult. They wore dark robes, sigils woven into the fabric resembling both the machine cog and the eight-pointed star, the mark of ruin, of evil. She had underestimated them, both their reach and the depths of their depravity. Arrogance had blinded her. Impatience had sealed her fate. They reduced her to a subject, an experiment. They remade her, cut her flesh, emptied her, and refilled the void with horrors before restitching her again. I am a vessel for their evil. The heavy stub pistol glinted in the coarse light of the ablution cell. Morgravia reached for it, contrition framing her expression, as she gathered the sidearm into her grasp and looked down upon the empath. She was dead, frostbitten and cold to the touch. Tiny icicles glittered on her eyelashes like diamonds. I am the signal, she uttered, unsurprised at the bitterness in her voice. Not only had the Valgast violated her flesh, they had engineered it so she would betray herself and all she stood for. It was a hard pill to swallow. So she put the gun into her mouth instead, bit down on the barrel, angling it just right so it would blow out the back of her head. One pull, her life for thousands. It wasn't suicide. It was necessary. A sacrifice. Stop the signal. End the threat. She would not become an abomination. Not for them. Morgravia closed her eyes, felt her finger tightening on the trigger. Just a little pressure needed. Then hesitated. It wasn't enough. The cult had to burn, root and branch. It was the only way to be sure they were done. Easing her finger off the trigger, she gagged, tears in her eyes, as she removed the gun barrel from her mouth. The taste of it lingered, warm metal and cordite. She took a long, shuddering breath, and hauled herself to her feet. Barak and Jaina were waiting for her as she trudged back to the rig. The ex-proctor looked sallow, leaning heavily against the rig, Jaina by his side. Where are the others? She asked, silently noting the Inquisitor's haggard appearance. I heard gunshots. Dead. Drover killed the broker, and I killed Drover. Morgravia replied flatly, and kept on walking. Take the rig. Get to the gate. She dug around in her long coat, pulling out her inquisitorial rosette. She tossed it to Jaina, who scrambled to catch it. What's this? And what do you mean they're dead? What's happening? An ending, at last. She gestured to the rosette. You'll need that. They won't let you through without it. Say you're my acolytes. that you're on Inquisition business. They'll be too afraid to challenge you. Easier just to let you through. At least I hope they will. Barak stepped into Morgravia's path as she was passing the rig. He gently clasped her wrist and asked very softly, "Why are they dead?" "Because neither were what they seemed," Morgravia told him. "And nor am I, it would appear." If Barak thought anything about that last remark, he didn't mention it. "But we can't just leave you here," he said. "I won't do it." "I walk alone, Barak," Morgravia said. "I have to. It's not safe for either of you. You have to let me." He held her gaze for a moment, as if gauging her veracity, then nodded, letting his hand fall to his side.
"You're headed to the church, aren't you?"
"In a manner of speaking, I am." He nodded at that, too, though the tension in his jawline told her he wanted to come with her and avenge the dead from Precinct 9.
"Be careful," said Barak.
"Just reach the gate. If I fail, it'll be all that stands between the plague and the rest of the hive. I'd prefer you on the other side of it."
Barak looked like he wanted to say more, but thought better of it. Morgravia preferred it that way. She had never been one for sentiment, and felt nothing of it now. She carried on walking.
"We won't meet again," she called back. "And do not try to find me,
because I'll be dead."
Barak gave no answer. A few minutes later, the rig sputtered and chugged away into the distance. A lonely figure waited for her in the shadows. It was short and lithe and held itself with a dancer's poise. But Morgravia knew better. A stir of old memories swirled to the forefront of her mind as she looked at Hel. A young girl, nervous and afraid, barefoot as she held on to her mother's hand. At the Temple of the Sanguinous, its huge bronze doors opening. A forbidding darkness and the scent of death. A tiny hand slipping loose from hers as soft footsteps led up to the threshold. Innocence sacrificed. Silent tears. Darkness all-consuming. The doors shut on one life, then open on another. Loss compounded by loss and magnified.
"I have found you, Mother,"
uttered Hel, and gave a shallow curtsy.
"Not just me," Morgravia replied. "You've something else, haven't you?"
Hel bowed.
"Have you remembered?"
"Some."
"Follow me then. I know the way."
Morgravia fought back grief, fought the urge to touch Hel's face, to feel the innocence she knew had long departed. It was a longing in her, a deep yearning. She betrayed none of this, for she did not understand it, the lacuna in her memories conspiring to elude her. Chapter 26. Faith. The unbelievers burned. They burned all the way to the bone, writhing in their cages, skin blackening, until nothing remained but ash. Those in the pens, still awaiting their fate, were made to watch. Some wept, others looked on with dull fascination. Most of the prisoners huddled together in groups, some because they were kindred, others out of a simple tribalism. Mankind is not meant to live alone. Its evolutionary cycle is driven by the innate desire to propagate. Every man requires a clan. It is primordial, an imperative survival instinct. For alone a man is weak, but together he is strong. He is also stupid, thought Christo, reflecting on these words he had read once. A mob mentality had overtaken the cult. Their demagogue, Convocation, the firebrand and stoker of its aberrant beliefs. He promulgated as he murdered and immolated, professing the Emperor's will and offering those in the flames to the darkness below. What horrors lay in that abyssal deep, Christo could not begin to fathom,
but the thought of drifting down into it as nothing more than charred bone and ash terrified him. It terrified him more than death or pain, for he was forced to acknowledge that some sliver of him might believe there was something in that darkness. A misappropriation for certain, but he felt it, a confession he had only recently admitted to himself as he looked upon the pit. A presence. He wondered if those suspended above it, in the moments before their deaths, felt it too. He kept Corinna close. She had said little since regaining consciousness. A part of him wished she had not. At least then she would be spared this hell. Literal, fiery, fucking hell. A few factorum workers, bullet makers and armour shapers, clustered with them. Clans. He only realised Celestia had slipped away when it was too late. She stood alone, apart from any tribe, for hers was dead, immolated by fire just like those in the cages, or else devoured by some devolved version of mankind. They too had a tribe, the cannibalistic creatures, a horde, though they did not seem to trouble the church. Perhaps that was how Convocation had yoked so many to his cult. He had offered protection, a haven from the dead, and though ignorant of how he had prevailed, he had called it, like so many small-minded men who crave power do, faith. That which cannot be proven, it must only be adhered to, blindly and absolutely, to the destruction of anything raised in opposition to it, however rational. Christo reached out, shrugging his way through the crowded pen as he tried to get to Celestia. Blasphemy. She said it quietly at first, an appraisal and confirmation all at once. Blasphemy, she uttered, louder, getting the attention of a masked acolyte who approached the pens, a cudgel gripped easily in her fist.
Shut up,
snarled the acolyte, threatening with the cudgel. Shoulders straight, chin raised, Celestia faced her down. Blasphemy! The acolyte lashed out, but Christo weathered the blow, interceding on Celestia's behalf.
Don't touch her,
he snarled, his paternal instincts extending beyond just his daughter. He saw Corinna moving up, but warned her off with a look. He was in this now. She didn't have to be. The acolyte summoned several of her cohorts, some freshly anointed and eager to vent their fear by inflicting suffering on the helpless. Christo was far from that, but he was outnumbered. As if sensing the change in mood, the frightened cattle in the pens shuffled back and a gap formed between Christo and Celestia and the rest.
Defiance will not be tolerated,
the acolyte told them in a low voice that promised the violence to come.
You must be judged.
The gate to the pen opened, the guards either side ready with shabby-looking autoguns to scythe down anyone who attempted to flee. The memory of the other attempted escapees still lingered, fresh, pinning the prisoners in place. Christo was about to step up as the slighted acolyte and her thugs entered the pen, but felt a light touch upon his shoulder that kept him back. He turned. Celestia